From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. This week, Obama and the economy. Anthony Weiner exposed again, a big insider trading indictment, a royal baby. On Wednesday, President Obama spoke at Knox College in Illinois on the economy and the middle class.
We need a long-term American strategy based on steady, persistent effort to reverse the forces that have conspired against the middle class for decades. That has to be our project.
On Tuesday, New York City mayoral candidate Anthony Weiner gave one crazy press conference. He admitted that he continued sexting women, not his wife, after his resignation from Congress in disgrace over sexting in 2011.
In the early days of the campaign, people were pressing me for, is there more out there? And I said, yes. I said that there was.
Yes, there was. And a future king is born on Monday. Royal baby mania for George Alexander Louis. Here were the proud royal parents outside the hospital in London.
Any parents would probably sort of know what this feeling feels like.
So. Very special.
This hour on Point, our weekly news roundtable with Major Garrett of CBS News, Annie Lowry of the New York Times, and On Point news analyst Jack Beatty. You can join us on air or online where this conversation is always on. How would you have voted on the NSA, student loans, SAC capital, the name George? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. With us now from Washington is Major Garrett, Chief White House Correspondent for CBS News and Correspondent at Large with National Journal. Major, welcome back to On Point.
Hey, Tom.
Great to have you here. Also from Washington, Annie Lowry, Economic Policy Correspondent at the New York Times. Annie Lowry, welcome.
Hi, Tom.
And from Hanover, New Hampshire, Jack Beatty joins us. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom, Major, and Annie.
Can we get Anthony Weiner out of the way first? I'm so eager to kind of have this
please
out of the way, but there it is all over. I'll start with you, Major. You're not in New York. He is. He's running for mayor. He was in Washington. He resigned over this, and now he says, I still did it after my resignation. What is it in American politics or in, I don't know, in his mind that he's still in the race?
Well, I think this is not a commentary or does not lend itself to a commentary on what's wrong with American politics. I think it leads singularly to a commentary on what's wrong with Anthony Weiner. Even by the standards of egotistical and egomaniacal political actors, Anthony Weiner has taken this to an absurd level. I mean, not only is he obviously a disturbed person, but he has absolutely zero judgment and zero regard for the natural process of accountability in any form of life, whether it's public life or private life. He lied to members of the press corps and the Democratic caucus when the scandal originally broke, and he was trying to cling to his seat in the House of Representatives, one he ultimately had to relinquish. And he lied to his wife, and he lied to the voters in New York as they were trying to evaluate his candidacy for the mayoral position in New York. And he is staying in this race for reasons I think only understandable to him. They're not understandable to the major news organizations in New York who have prominently editorialized for him to drop out. He's sinking quite understandably in the polling in New York's mayor's race. And he is on the verge, if he hasn't already crossed the line, of someone who is not just a joke, but a pitiful one.
The numbers, who knows? Here he was, I mean, the spotlight's still on him, and he appears to be reveling in it. On Thursday in Brooklyn, still mayoral candidate Anthony Weiner admitted he had inappropriate online relationships with maybe 6 to 10 women.
All I can say to this is it's not dozens, just like I told the Post, and they made a big headline out of it. It's not dozens and dozens. It is 6 to 10, I suppose, but I can't tell you absolutely what someone else is going to consider inappropriate or not.
And hey, it's not dozens. Here was his wife at a press conference on Tuesday, Huma Abedin, standing by her man, saying she had forgiven him.
I love him. I have forgiven him. I believe in him. And as we have said from the beginning, we are moving forward.
Annie, how do you read this picture?
Well, I think that one of the most curious things about this whole affair is that Anthony Weiner went through this very carefully orchestrated process of kind of a public mea culpa, of explaining what he did wrong, of allowing reporters into his life, into his apartment to see his family.
Back when he was resigning from Congress and coming back and then into public life, you mean?
Yeah, exactly. And more recently this spring, kind of setting the path towards running for mayor, which is obviously a really, really big, high profile job. And I think that it's just mystifying to people in the press why you wouldn't have had this come out then, why you wouldn't have just gotten all of the skeletons out of your closet at that point and then seen if it was viable for you to run. So I think this kind of second humiliation of his family has made him look really, 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 really bad. This isn't a guy who's had some accidents. This is a guy who can't stop himself from doing this. And, you know, so when you have a politician who's coming out and saying it wasn't dozens, it was merely 6 to 10 people I was sexting with after I resigned from Congress and said that I had stopped doing it, things have gone really awry. I think that the public perception has really changed. And I think that there's kind of always second acts in American public life. It's funny, these not just men, but very often men who go through these kind of humiliating sex scandals very often do come back. And we're seeing it, obviously, with Spitzer. But with Wiener, this has just become kind of farcical. And it's really painful to watch, I think.
But she's still standing by him. Huma Abedin, close to Hillary Clinton, has been counseled by her at points, we're told. What do you think of that at this point, Annie? I mean, it's their business, but still, again and again and again, the wife who stands there at the humiliating press conference of her guy, still there in all of this?
Yeah, I mean, I think that the perception is that she's getting humiliated again, and I have no idea how it feels to her and how it feels to their family. But it reflects so badly on Anthony Weiner that this is happening a second time. And we know that people in Clinton land are infuriated. They were furious the first time. They're even more furious the second time. And I think that they worry about how this might reflect on the Clintons, who, you know, this is bringing up some things that happened in their marriage, obviously, decades ago at this point, that I think that especially folks who are close to Hillary Clinton wish that people weren't talking about.
Jack Clinton's furious at a sex scandal is kind of rich in itself. On the other hand, I mean, this whole thing raises the sort of question of, is there no line beyond which? I mean, if he were to be somehow elected mayor, and people are saying now he will not be, but I don't know, does that mean that sexting, your privates is now just, that's just part of normal American etiquette? You can just say, oh, excuse me, and on you go?
The future is safe for sexting. I can't imagine it. I mean, maybe in the future we'll cross that line, but I don't really want to be here when we do. we really want to spare a little indignation for the left coast, the Pacific, San Diego specifically.
Yeah, the mayor.
Bob Filner, the mayor there, this week, it's no less than 7 women have come forward with grotesque stories about his sexual harassment of them. And the city attorney has ruled that the Mayor Filner cannot spend time alone with a woman on city property.
Any woman on any city property?
Any woman on any city property. Now, this has been rendered somewhat complicated or problematic by the mayor's hiring a new chief of staff who happens to be a woman.
They can meet at a McDonald's or something.
There you go.
Oh, my gosh. I don't know what to do with all that. We're watching you, New York City, to see what you do with this candidate, the whole country, and San Diego, for that matter. I want to move on to media matters, and there are plenty. President Obama taking the economy theme back to the public this week. He was at Knox College up in Galesburg, Illinois. Know it well. Kicked off a series of speeches that he's intending to give on the economy. Said the U.S. economy would be okay in the short term if we don't act. We just muddle along. But he went on, the U.S. will start to fall behind if we do not invest in infrastructure and education now.
Businesses of tomorrow will not locate near old roads and outdated ports. They'll relocate to places with high-speed internet and high-tech schools and systems that move air and auto traffic faster. And not to mention, we'll get parents home quicker from work because we'll be eliminating some of these traffic jams. And we can watch all of that happen in other countries and start falling behind.
Or we can do something about it. Even before he spoke, a pre-buttal from Speaker of the House John Boehner said, hey, this is all, there's nothing to this. John Boehner.
What's it going to accomplish? Probably got the answer. Nothing. It's a hollow shell. It's an Easter egg with no candy in it.
Annie Lowrey, what's going on with this series of speeches? Is there something new the president's saying, or is it the same message he's been giving throughout the campaign season last year?
There isn't very much new here. It was an interesting, somewhat academic speech that he gave, which is about what he perceives as the structural problems in the American economy, the growing inequality, the wage stagnation that workers have been dealing with for 30 years, you know, 25 mm-hmm. years now. And the issue, and I think that this gets to Boehner's comments, is that there's a lot that the president would like to do about this. He has already done a fair amount of legislating to tackle these deep problems. I would point to his tax bill, which made the tax code more progressive by raising taxes on the wealthy and locking in these tax cuts for working poor families, and the Affordable Care Act, which at its heart transfers money from rich people in the form of tax raises and gives it in form of services, in form of medical services to lower income families. But the issue is that he can't get any of this done without Congress. And it's not clear that getting out on a podium and yelling at Congress is going to convince them to work with him on these issues. I think that President Obama is trying to wrench the conversation back to the economy after a couple months where it's been all about scandal. It's been about immigration. It's been about guns. It's been about other priorities. It hasn't really been about the economic problems plaguing the country, but it will be this fall. There's going to be a fight over the debt ceiling. There's going to be a fight over continuing resolutions. And I think that President Obama wants to come out with a more populist message.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're looking at a week in the news. President Obama on the economy. Wiener does it again. Royal baby mania. A big hedge fund indicted. In on insider trading, we've got the NSA vote, student loans in the news, Egypt, and maybe peace talks in the Middle East. With Annie Lowrey, economic policy correspondent for The New York Times. Major Garrett, White House correspondent for CBS News. Jack Beatty is here. And Major, I want to come to you on the president and the economy. What about the message? What about the timing? This is setting up for the big fiscal debate. What's the positioning here? And what about the actual guts of what he's saying?
Well, I was with the president both in Galesburg, Illinois, and Warrensburg, Missouri, and he was inspired, as he often is, by getting outside of Washington and getting into something that's a bit more frothy and has a bit more of campaign gusto theatrics to it. The president sort of gets more of his bearings in that environment than he does in the day-to-day hassling with Congress inside the Beltway. Be that as it may, I think Annie is right. This speech had a sort of larger, long-term economic context, but it is really about an immediate confrontation the White House sees almost to be unavoidable with Republicans in Congress over three issues. What is the country going to do about this year's sequestration, automatic across-the-board spending cuts, and the ones due to begin next year in the next fiscal year? That's one. Mm-hmm. Two, what are we going to do about the debt ceiling? And three, is there going to be any larger conversation about a big deal on tax reform, entitlement reform, the grand bargain? The first two are of very immediate interest and concern at the White House because they don't believe, for economic reasons and within their own Democratic base, another year of these across-the-board spending cuts will be good for the country or good for Democratic constituencies who are incredibly angry about the cuts they're seeing inflicted. They're happy that the defense budget is being cut, but they are not happy with the across-the-board federal spending cuts on things like Head Start, aid to the elderly, and things like that. The White House has got to try to figure out, and is trying to figure out a way to set the political groundwork for a debate about getting rid of those across-the-board spending cuts and coming up with something else. On the question of the debt ceiling, the president in both places, Galesburg and Warrensburg, said we cannot have an artificial crisis about paying our bills. There is no resolution of that. Republicans are staking out terrain, similarly to what they did in January, that they're not going to do this without a confrontation. The Republicans may back off on that, but the White House doesn't know. So this return to the economy had a sort of larger, over-the-horizon, 10-year sort of aspect to it, but really it is about trying to change the political conversation in advance of these conversations that are going to start in September and will play themselves out in a very real way in October. And if the White House doesn't prevail, not only does it believe the president will suffer politically, but they believe the nation will suffer economically.
Jack, Annie, I want to come to you further on this. Let's get our listeners in. Wilmot in Charleston, South Carolina. Wilmot, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Thanks for taking my call, Tom.
Mm-hmm.
I'm interested in seeing and hoping that the president will address more directly the fundamental causes of problems in our economy. We know that this the economy pushing more and more money into the hands of the 1% and less money into the hands of the 99% results in periodic breakdowns and recessions in the economic system. As a result of that, this is the economic cycle of capitalism. We know that it exists. We know it has existed for a long period of time. How to remedy that and how to find American solutions to that is what we need to be looking for. And I think that the solutions proposed by the technocrats during the 1930s, after the Great Depression, can inform us from our own history today. I think we need to be looking at taxing of machines, especially computers, that take away the kind of work that people used to do for a long period of time. By taxing the machines and using the income from the taxing of machines to fund employment, new employment, and leisure for people so that they have time to spend with their families and raise better children might be a solution to many of our economic and social problems.
Women, I've got the angle, and I mean, you're looking for solutions there, and I want to take that on, Annie. You know, there's political positioning here, but there is a hunger. I think the president's right in speaking to it in this country to think through what's really going on. I mean, what about you hear Wilmot's angle. What about the conversation among economists about inequality and whether it's actually is a drag on the economy overall, a problem that we need to address to have a healthy economy?
Well, this is something that economists are researching. There's a ton of research as to this question. And the evidence that we have so far, the studies that we have so far, they aren't the strongest. They aren't the most conclusive. But probably the best comes from the IMF. And it does seem to show that not especially in high-income countries like the United States, but in lower-income countries, higher levels of inequality depress growth. And there's a lot of channels through which that happens. But one theoretical channel is that, you know, if you're kind of a middle-income family, you spend a lot of your income on things like cars, on schooling, on driving around, on clothes. You're using a higher proportion of your income and flushing it back into the economy. And the issue is that if all of this money is ending up in the hands of the rich, they aren't driving the consumer economy in the same way. And I think that the caller kind of pointed out that one interesting thing, which is that at some point, I'm not sure that any policy, even if Barack Obama were king and could make any rules that he wanted, would be really effective against these big economic tidal forces of globalization, of technological advance, and of the declining return to labor. It's this really big question, and I don't think that there's good answers in the realm of policy, aside from kind of papering over.
Jack, I mean, you know people are genuinely worried about the economy, even now when it's come back some, but nobody knows how it's going to go. There's political positioning going on here, as Major says, undeniable. I mean, that's partly how democracy works, but yet people... I think there is a response to the president's call. Look, let's do the necessary to get going here and not flounder around. And what do you see coming out of this, Jack? The Republicans say, look, he's just infatuated with rhetoric. And as Boehner said, that's a Easter egg with nothing inside.
Well, you know, Abraham Lincoln debated Stephen Douglas at Knox College in Galesburg, and according to a Knox College legend, he had to sneak in the window in order to get into the building, Lincoln did. And Lincoln used a phrase we've heard before, the fostering hand of government, and really that's what the president was talking about here, one of the things, and he was saying, look, yes, there are these trends, they are not inexorable. We can resist them. Decent jobs in manufacturing, we can have manufacturing centers that help to have the best ideas in manufacturing, and government can help. Housing, owning your own home, we can help there. We can take an idea from Mitt Romney's economic advisor and lower interest rates for everybody. Everybody can refund their mortgage, essentially getting a big tax cut. Education, yes, he said, we can go ahead with student loans, but we also have to do something about this meter fear that's running education. More loans every year, higher prices. We've got to get the cost of education down. Healthcare security. He says, look, it's already putting, you know, prices in California and in New York are already coming down under the Affordable Care Act. We need more of that. Retirement security. He tied that into the immigration bill. And he said, you know, if you want to save Social Security, you got to be for immigration reform. In short, he said, we're not helpless. These are not trends that we can, you know, just have to, that are just going to happen. The fostering hand of government can help work through them.
Well, there's the president's position, but the, you know, the rejoinder is government's not the way. Empty Easter egg. Jerome in, speaking of Abraham Lincoln Land, Decatur, Illinois. Jerome, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I think one of the things that we need is an executive that sits down and deals directly with the people in power in Washington, D.C. This continuously campaigning and running around and giving speeches and being somewhat divisive in the speeches is not really helping the economy or the American people. I think it was kind of telling this week when Boehner said, not judging on how many bills they passed, but how many bills that they have not passed or kept from being passed. I think that these executive orders that have basically killed the coal industry, the pipeline, and the fact that so many people are only getting part-time work because of the fear of Obamacare is not helping the economy.
Jerome, I've got it. I appreciate your call. I mean, Major, I don't know what to say there. I mean, yes, Boehner's saying, let's be judged by how many what laws we repeal. Jerome wants the president to sit down with the powers that be in Washington and work it out and not be delivering executive orders. Is there something to be worked out here, or does that head right back in the logjam? Can we have a sensible conversation in Washington, do the right thing, or is the gap too wide, the positioning too hard?
Well, from the White House perspective, John Boehner, who said that to my colleague at CBS, Bob Schieffer, on Face the Nation, in like one sentence crystallized the difficulty and the reason the White House rejects the idea that if the president simply sat down on a daily basis with John Boehner, the Speaker of the House, and Mitch McConnell, the Republican leader in the Senate, these things could be worked out. The White House perspective is John Boehner either is unalterably opposed to everything the president wants to do or most of what the president wants to do. And when he's able to find the votes, he succeeds in trying to undercut that. And other times when he simply opposes it and can't find the votes to do so, he looks incompetent. But in neither case is he someone the president feels he can deal with. Now, the Speaker's office and Republicans would say, look, we do have a perspective that's different from the president's. We will take our votes because our party wants us to, but we can make a deal, but you have to talk to us. And what has been the largest central misunderstanding, and basically this is baked in the mistrust between the two sides, the White House doesn't believe those conversations are going to go anywhere. Republicans, with their legislative actions, cutting the president's budget in many respects, sticking with the sequestration across the board cuts, are signaling they're not really prepared to move very far off their base. And for that reason, they stare at each other a lot more than they cooperate with each other. And if that's the only choice left, the president much prefers to get out to Galesburg or Warrensburg, Missouri.
Yeah, no question. Zach in Peoria, Illinois, not so far down the pike from Galesburg. Zach, thanks for calling.
Hey, Tom, how you doing?
Okay.
All right, so my question is this. I listen to a lot of stuff on your show, and I do a lot of research online. Why is it that the presidents or anybody that's talking about economics can have a solid conversation about economics without talking about the four companies that essentially own the world? It's Fidelity, Vanguard, State Street, and BlackRock. Those four companies actually have together control of 60% of the income of the planet and 40% of the net worth of the planet. So, obviously, those are four very important players, which through owning actually is one solid entity because they own each other. So, how can we should talk about the impact of those four companies / one corporation on the Earth's economy.
Zach, I appreciate your call. I mean, there's four very big ones. Of course, you can cite more. Yes, there are big companies that move around a lot of capital. Annie Lauer, you cover economics. How do you respond to that concern out of the heartland?
Well, I think that you're right, that there are really, really big financial players that have gotten bigger since the financial crisis. But the one thing about the asset managers that you're talking about is in a lot of ways they're just conduits, right? They take money and then they use it to invest elsewhere. So it's not like they're holding on to that money, right? They're going to go buy stocks. They're going to go buy bonds. They're going to go buy little bits of Walmart or little bits of this railroad. And so that money isn't actually as concentrated and dispersed as you might think just looking at their books. But that said, there has been a lot of concern that the big players have gotten bigger. And from Washington's perspective, the issue with that is that the markets perceive still a federal guarantee on these really big, systemically important firms. Their cost of financing are lower because of that guarantee. This is the problem known as too big to fail. And it's still very present. It's still something that people in Washington worry about. And some people argue that Dodd-Frank, which was Obama's financial regulatory reform law, doesn't do enough to end that problem.
Big moves on one very big financial company, hedge fund, this week. Criminal charges just yesterday against SAC Capital, huge hedge fund run by the billionaire Stephen Cohen. What do those charges say? This has been bubbling along for a while now, but here it is, and it's tough. What's the message, Annie?
So SAC Capital is this big, big, big hedge fund. They've previously paid a $616 million fine to the SEC to settle charges of insider trading. And they are now facing a criminal suit and a civil suit. And this is a really, really big deal. And there's the perception that this is in part the feds deciding to go very publicly after these people that didn't really get punished after the financial crisis. And I think that the bigger question is that, you know, hedge funds were not actually terribly instrumental in the housing bubble, in foreclosure fraud. But nevertheless, you know, there's this idea that the feds have been handling Wall Street with kid gloves and that now they want to take those kid gloves off. And so they did not actually indict Stephen Cohen, who is the SAC of the SAC
Founder.
Capital.
Yep.
But this is a big, big, big case. And it's not clear that SAC is going to be able to settle its way out of it.
Tom in Brattleboro, Vermont. Tom, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I called in on the SAC thing. I think this is pretty much a lawless situation with these hedge funds operating for years, engaging in insider trading. You know, whether Mr. Cohen had control or not over the traders who were principally involved in the insider trading. He is responsible, and I think he probably knew what was going on and encouraged it because of the outlandish profits he was realizing. This is way overdue. The Justice Department needs to get a lot stronger with their enforcement, and these people are undertaxed. I mean, Mr. Cohen bought a piece of artwork for nearly $250 million from Steve Wynn.
No shortage of cash there. Hey, Tom, we're up against a break. Thank you for your call. Annie, can hedge funds survive and prosper with tighter boundaries here? I mean, that's what's really being laid down. The charges insider trading, you just can't, you know, play that fast and loose, the government's saying. Do hedge funds still work in that kind of environment?
Well, I mean, the indictment against SAC is completely damning. And it says that basically the fund was making money almost exclusively in some cases from insider trading. Insider trading is very, very clearly illegal. And so I think that the question is can hedge funds be profitable? Can they be consistently market beating if they aren't using insider information? And I think that there's really serious questions about that, about the viability of the model in the longer term. I think, again, that I come back to this question, you know, it is illegal to insider trade, but again, hedge funds were not really terribly important in all of the financial problems that we've been seeing in the past 5 years now.
No, I guess, but you talk about concentrated wealth, and there's a lot, no small chunk of it right in that $250 million painting Tom raises on the wall. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. In other news this week, Pope Francis made his first international trip as Pope to Brazil. Here he is yesterday speaking to a crowd in Rio, a favela, a slum there, in Portuguese, saying that a society is most importantly measured by the way it treats the poor and those most in need.
A medida da grandeza de una sociedade é dada pelo modo como esta trata os mais necessitados, que não tem outra coisa.
The Pope speaking up there for the poor on Wednesday. A high-speed train crashed in Spain. At least 80 people have been killed. Here's an eyewitness who helped after the accident.
It felt like a thunderstorm, like an earthquake with rocks falling, a very strong blow. We ran here after we called for help. We opened the back of the wagon and we started to help people to get out and to move the dead bodies which were on the road.
And Anthony Weiner and his online sexting handle, Carlos Danger, were the butt of a lot of jokes on late-night TV. Here's Jimmy Fallon, late-night on NBC.
Carlos Danger is what he was having the conversation with this woman. That was his code name, which is still easier to believe than that other name, Mayor Weiner. It's still good. I don't understand that one either.
We're looking at a week in the news. You can join us. Was Congress right not to crack down on NSA surveillance? Is Eric Holder right to put the grips on Texas voting? Your thoughts on George Alexander Louis, future king, royal baby mania, and are you feeling the love for George Bush Sr. shaving his head for that sweet kid? I am. Major Garrett here, White House correspondent for CBS News. Annie Lowry, economic policy correspondent for the New York Times, and Jack Beatty. Let's go to Janet in Buffalo, New York. Janet, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
So I'm actually not bothered at all by Anthony Weiner continuing to sex. I think that we have a really sex-negative culture, and it's not like he did what Elliot Spitzer did, which is using public money and public time and public funds to act inappropriately. What he's doing is in his private life, and I'm a little bothered by some people in the press acting like, oh, no, he lied to us. Well, of course he lied, because we have such a sex-negative culture that what is he supposed to say? Oh, I do this kinky thing where I really like to sex a lot of different women. I mean, that's a completely unacceptable thing to say in our culture, but yet he's a person, he's a human, and he has his kinks and his sex life and his sexual preferences. I don't even think it should be in the news.
So if he's mayor of New York or a congressman or president of the United States and he's tweeting photographs of his genitalia, that's fine by you, even though he's married?
Well, you know, that's between him and his wife, and his wife has made her statements. I think if it is news, it would be about, is he harassing women? And if they're willing participants, you know, there are sex addictions. So if somebody is going through a alcoholic relapse, we don't kick them out of office.
Janet, we got it. Maybe someday down the road that view will prevail. I don't know. I mean, we'll see what New York voters do. We'll see what Weiner does. His wife stood up this week and talked about it as, you know, terrible, terrible mistakes. What they actually think about it, we'll see how society evolves. You're out there on the curve, Janet, and I appreciate your call. Let me get one more here from Buffalo. Galen, you're on, Galen.
Hi, Tom. Question for you. How would you justify the NSA director meeting with congressional leaders to persuade them not to vote for NSA oversight? Isn't that like a breach in powers between the two branches?
Well, it was certainly the question of the week, a really interesting question in Washington. Let us look at it, Galen. I mean, Major, here we had the first vote since the whole Edward Snowden leak broke all this new perspective on the National Security Agency, NSA, and a tight vote, 217 to 205 in the House.
Absolutely, Tom. This was almost, for the intelligence community, an Edward Snowden apocalypse because it required a tremendous amount of last-minute, feverish lobbying from the White House, from the intelligence community, from the senior Republican leadership in the House.
And explain what was going on. This was a funding appropriations bill for the Pentagon, huge one.
Right. This was a defense appropriations bill, a defense authorization bill, and it had in it an amendment, as often occurs in the House and the Senate. You can bring ideas relevant to the underlying legislation, and this particular idea was, by the hand of those who wrote it, Justin Amash of Utah and John Conyers of Michigan, if in the future, the NSA wanted to conduct surveillance of phone logs or internet metadata, it could only do that on Americans who had been named in an ongoing investigation.
Yeah.
It could not do so in a completely broad and unfettered and, in their terminology, suspicionless context.
And there were many in both parties who were ready to go with this amendment, these constraints.
Yes, absolutely. And on the final vote, it was 217 to 205, about as close a kind of vote as you see in the modern Congress, where typically things fall, if they are close, on distinctly party lines. This was a very much of a bipartisan mishmash on both sides. You had 114 Democrats vote for this, 83 vote against it, 94 Republicans vote yes, 134 voted no. If you voted no, you were essentially endorsing the existing NSA
yep.
metadata and phone log collection process. But it was a very close vote. The White House had to get involved in this. There were very serious conversations on the floor of the House as this was being debated and it was being voted on. And it is a clear sign to the White House and to the intelligence community, but I think particularly to the president, that he's got to engage this issue on an ongoing basis and explain more clearly than he has so far about what this program does, what its benefits are, what future constraints he may be willing to place upon it, because this was, if nothing else, very much a shot across the bow that came up with basically a week of pre-debate. There wasn't a huge national conversation about this, and yet it almost passed.
I mean, you have to say Edward Snowden, still stuck in that airport in Moscow, did get his issue up on the boards. This was a little bit of the debate on...
In ways that was inconceivable before
inconceivable. Those leaks. So much is out there now. Here was Republican Congressman from Texas, Joe Barton, on the House floor Wednesday evening in support of an amendment that would have reined in the NSA here.
This is not about how sincere the NSA people are in implementing this technique. It is not about how careful they are. It is whether they have the right to collect the data in the first place on every phone call, on every American, every day. The Patriot Act did not specifically authorize it.
Let's rein it in, says the Texas congressman. But another from Michigan, this is Mike Rogers, said, hey, there's a real threat out there. We can't stop this stuff.
It's not theoretical. 54 times this and the other program stopped and thwarted terrorist attacks both here and in Europe, saving real lives. This isn't a game. This is real. It will have a real consequence.
Jack Beatty, Edward Snowden's still in trouble in that airport, but he must be watching this with enormous interest. He has really got something going here.
He's accomplished, really, the main part of what he set out to do. The president said, I want a debate on this. I welcome it. Well, now he's got it. And, you know, people, I think when this first came out, you heard some people say, wait a minute, didn't we have an election? Didn't we elect a different president? Wasn't his whole position, we're going to move away from the national security, national surveillance state of the Bush administration into an era when rights are balanced against security. That hasn't happened. And now, I think Major is right. The handwriting is on the wall. You quoted Chairman Rogers. He's going to, in the fall, come up with a bill starting to reform this, starting to give more transparency to this. Meanwhile, his colleagues have really come up with other ideas. They want to declassify these opinions from the FISA court. They want to change the way these FISA judges are appointed, let Congress appoint some of them. They want to appoint a public advocate to this court to allow the case to be made on the other side. As it is, you know, there's only one side in these courts. That's the government side. And they want to end this phone metadata collection on constitutional grounds. So the clock is ticking, I think, on this what many think is an overreach.
Let's, David in Hartford, Connecticut. David, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Yes, sir.
I just thought I'd chime in. First thing, I looked at the NPR website, and the first story that caught my eye was that CNET magazine is reporting that the NSA, the federal government, are requesting user passwords from the 10 or 15 largest Internet providers. So for anyone who thinks that I've got nothing to hide, they might want to rethink if somebody who's even a rogue employee of the federal government could go in and use their account for
anything they want to do.
Yeah.
having a password available to them.
David, we've got it. I mean, that's kind of implicit in some of what's going on here, but requesting the very passwords and they're in. The way this shapes up in the next big election round is going to be interesting. We read Chris Christie out at a conference in Colorado saying, hey, the danger's real. We need to have this kind of surveillance major. He's taking out that ground against Rand Paul in this very early pre-presidential campaign season.
Absolutely, saying that libertarians are theoretical and they don't understand the risks, they don't understand the dangers, and they don't understand conversing, as Chris Christie has. This is getting into his very direct New Jersey relationship to 9/11 and the New Jersey families affected then and forever by 9/11. And that is a way of Chris Christie saying, I'm going to take this on from a national security perspective. I'm already thinking about this as a future presidential candidate and as someone who is not going to sort of take the libertarian bait, which is what he perceives it to be, both as a matter of substance and a matter of politics. And one quick thing, Tom, I need to amend. Justin Amish is also from Michigan. John Kiner, I said he was from Utah. Mm-hmm. Let me just correct that. He's from Michigan.
Mm-hmm. Student loans. I want to look at this for a second. A different kind of politics going on here. A change this week that would bring it back down from the jump that was underway. Undergraduates able to borrow at 3.9% for this school year. Graduate students, 5.4%. Parents at 6.4%, so some kind of lid put on right away. And caps, ultimately, it would go up as high as 8% for undergrads, 9.5% for grads, 10.5% for parents. Annie, what do you make of this? There were still calls to keep these things very low. Ultimately, you know, they've been brought back down, but everybody expects interest rates to go up, and these rates will go up a pretty good ways with them. Is it obvious why the government should be in this business of, does that mean profiting on student loans?
There's been some concerns that the government is profiting on these loans, but the truth is that it's not really, when you actually look at the amount of money that the government is making versus the risk that they're taking on, I don't think that that's a major factor here. But there's definitely in Congress a feeling that this issue needs to be addressed. But what's kind of funny about it is that there isn't a lot of pressure to get it done terribly immediately. Student loan rates have already doubled for new loans made since July 1st. Mm-hmm. But it's pretty easy to undo it. You can kind of just legislate backwards. So there isn't a ton of pressure to get this done right now. It's not like this is a crisis and this is going to totally mess up the student loan market going forward. And so what you're seeing is just a ton of back and forthing of caucuses breaking apart and coming together on this issue. I think that probably they will end up coalescing somewhere around tying this to prevailing loan rates, to the 10-year Treasury rate, for instance, or another federal funds rate. And it's just not clear that they can actually amass the political will to get this done, even though everybody thinks that they are going to do it. And even though there's some consensus about how.
Major, give us some perspective on Secretary of State John Kerry's work this week. He's got Middle East peace talks, apparently, coming up on the rails here. They're going to happen. This has been the holy grail again and again, but now it happens at a time when you got Egypt blowing up, Syria blowing up, Iran talking about wanting to talk about nuclear weapons. Great accomplishment here, or sideshow, or what's the perspective from Washington?
It's neither. It's not a great accomplishment, not yet at least, and it's certainly not a sideshow. What it does indicate, however, is the uncomfortable and rough realization that this president, like previous American presidents, have had to come to. President Obama said, I'm not interested, just like George W. Bush said, I'm not interested in talks about talks. I want an agenda, and I want an endpoint, and I want a goal, and I want everyone beforehand to resolve as much as they can before we get around a table. Well, that's not going to happen. We're going to have talks about talks, okay?
Yeah.
The top Israeli officials and Palestinian negotiators are going to come to Washington and talk about the process of getting toward these bigger issues. The one thing I would say that is interesting about this moment is that, as you mentioned, this hideous, grinding bloodbath of a civil war in Syria with all sorts of regional implications is just to the north of Israel and Jordan.
Mm-hmm.
Egypt's political turmoil is real, and nobody knows exactly where it's heading. And in this atmosphere, sort of within this vice of instability, I think it's worth pointing out that the Israelis and Palestinians are saying, wow, for the first time, we're not the most divisive forces in our neighborhood, and maybe there's an opportunity for us to profit from this greater instability around us by getting some of our issues resolved, or at least trying to resolve them to take advantage of the post-chaos situation around us. And I think that might be one of the things that's driving this new interest in conversation.
That would be amazing if that came out of all this fluidity, not to say crisis elsewhere. I want to reach back to an interesting statement. This was last week, but it got its attention this week. The Iowa Republican Congressman Steve King talking about young illegal immigrants, often called the sort of dreamers in America, as overwhelmingly drug mules or carriers. Other Republicans quickly distancing themselves from these comments. This was an interview with Newsmax last week. John Boehner called this wrong and hateful. House Majority Leader Eric Cantor, inexcusable, but here was Iowa's Congressman Stephen King talking about the Dreamers.
They aren't all valedictorians. They weren't all brought in by their parents. For everyone who's a valedictorian, there's another 100 out there that they weigh 130 pounds and they've got calves the size of cantaloupes because they're hauling 75 pounds of marijuana across the desert.
Bunch of drug mules. Major Garrett, what is that sentiment and where does that play in our ongoing politics?
Well, It's very difficult to respond to that seriously. Now, Steve King has always had a very aggressive anti-immigration, anti-illegal immigration point of view in his politics. He is the successor, if you will, to Tom Tancredo in the House Republican Conference. And in the main, his conversation about immigration has been hostile, but not abusively so. And it's just a term of language. Whenever you keep using they, impersonal third-party form of conversation, you are labeling an entire classification of people. And he did so. He's had to repeal. He's had to backpedal from that. Republicans are running from that as fast as they can. But the bottom line is, politically, they're still stuck on immigration. They don't know how to move forward. And comments like Steve King only intensify their sense of political paralysis.
Language like that can resonate for a long time. We're almost out of time. Annie Lowrey, Larry Summers for next Fed chief. Is that baked in the cake?
You know, it's not baked in the cake, but we're coming down to a decision which is expected sometime in August or September. And right now, the front runners are Janet Yellen, who's the vice chair of the Fed, and Larry Summers, and to a lesser extent, a guy named Roger Ferguson.
Watch this space. Annie Lowrey with The Times, Major Garrett at CBS News, Jack Beatty, thanks to you all. Listeners, have a great weekend. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.